Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirk the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day. And today, I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff. Welcome back to the Codgetorium, or the Codgetorium, as listener Mrs. Wid suggested. Welcome to the second part of episode 73, which is all about monsters in role-playing. This isn't another part, it's more like a fiend factory for the fiend folio. In this episode, we're really happy to speak to the Monster Man himself, James Holloway, who's created the Monster Man series of podcasts that explore all aspects of the monstrous behaviour in RPGs. We invited him to contribute to the Grognard Files Appendix G in the ever-expanding list of media that's inspired our gaming. He's great, and monsters are great. Blythe, our resident rules lawyer, joins us in the Zoom of role-playing rambling to share another Starburst memory, where we look at TV and film for inspiration and talk about some of the famous monsters of Hollywood and beyond. What's that coming over the hill? Why, it's the anticipation of a monster. You should also note that we make a significant gaffe early on, but we recover at the end. You'll hardly notice, unless you're a member of the Boosie family, in which case, apologies. Okay, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Appendix G.
Welcome to the Zoom of role-playing rambling, where I'm joined by James Holloway, the monster man himself, because monsters are great. And he's going to add to the ever-expanding Appendix G list of inspiration from the Grog Squad. Hello there, James.
Hello, Dirk.
So, James, where in the world are you beaming from today?
Despite my accent, I'm calling in from Cambridge, the Cambridge in England, obviously.
I think when you first started corresponding with me, it was about the Cambridge fanzine scene.
That's right. Yeah. So this was, I was given some years ago now. I mean, I don't even remember. It must be about 10 years ago now. There was the Cambridge University Role Playing and Tabletop Gaming Society, CURTS for short, was moving its library. And they decided to get rid of a lot of their old stuff, including loads of old White Dwarfs. And I was able to walk off with, well, I cycle off with a lot of them. And there were also, there were these weird old fanzines in there, and it was stuff that I'd never heard of. But I've learned a little bit more about them since, you know, since sort of corresponding with other Grog Squad people about, you know, where these came from and what they were all about. So, it's been very interesting.
Yeah. So these were ones that originated, was it around the 80s or was it a bit later than that?
They seem to me to be from the early 80s. Yeah. So they're talking in some cases about the release of the Fiend Folio, and that's 81. So, they must have literally been sitting in that same box for at that time 30 years, because it's hard to imagine that someone had really got them out in the intervening period. Like, there's not anything that, you know, that someone playing games in the 90s would have wanted to look at and go, well, I can apply this to my Vampire the Masquerade game.
Great. Nothing like finding treasure.
Yeah.
Your podcast has been an inspiration over the past few years.
Oh, thank you very much.
The Monster Man podcast. So if anybody out there has not heard about it, just give us the pitch and tell us what it's all about.
I mean, I can tell you on paper what it's about, which is that it's me going alphabetically through monsters in kind of classic RPG monster books. And to begin with, that's just what it was, is that I just, you know, I'd open up the monster manual and we started with Aerial Servant, obviously. Come on, yes. I know the answer to this question. Anyway, so you start with the Aerial Servant and work our way through the zombie. It started out with me just kind of saying whatever I happen to think about them. And then it became, you know, talking about the folklore and mythology that they came from, or you know, thinking about how to use them in games. Then as the Patreon expanded, one of the Patreon tiers is that you get to request a topic for a special episode. And so sometimes it'll just be like someone wanted me to go back and do a more detailed thing about trolls. And so I got to go and look at, you know, Old Norse poetry about trolls and things like that. But then sometimes people will ask me to do, I did one about cooking and eating monsters, one about the academic study of monsters, one about monsters from the Usagi Yojimbo role-playing game, one about monsters from Jack Kirby comics from the 70s, one about monsters from Hammer horror movies, one about monsters from Super Mario Brothers games. You know, it's just whatever people request. And so from its kind of like, the structure remains the same, which is that, you know, each season is me picking a new monster book and going through it. A whole lot of the rest of the show has sort of grown up around that. And then also for people that subscribe to my Patreon, there's a spinoff show, Patron Deities, which started out me going through deities and demigods and looking at like the real mythology behind each pantheon. But I ran out of deities and demigods chapters a long time ago. And so now it's just me going out and researching, you know, other mythologies and sort of how to incorporate them in games. So I did a season on Phoenician mythology. And then before that, I did one on voodoo and before, you know, whatever, just whatever the patrons vote for. So it's really educational for me. I get to go and try to learn as much as I can about, you know, about where these things come from. And I don't always get it. So like recently I've been discovering, thanks to another podcast that I listened to, the Chinese Lore podcast, which is about sort of classic Chinese literature, I've been discovering that a lot of the Chinese section of deities and demigods is taken from this one novel, like this one sort of like classic Chinese novel about the end of the Shang dynasty, in which a bunch of the weird characterizations, like, yeah, I was looking at this chapter and just going, where does this all come from? This isn't how these deities are worshipped or whatever. And the answer is it's from this one book, presumably then paraphrased in some other book, which is not to bag on. I'm not like trying to criticize Jim Ward or anybody. Like if you gave me the task of writing a chapter on Chinese mythology as a, you know, like an English teacher in small town Iowa in the late 1970s, you know, who presumably, and like, don't believe he reads Chinese, you know, and I certainly don't. He did the best he could under the circumstances, just that the circumstances kind of weird. But anyway, yeah, so I just, well, as you can kind of see from that whole explanation, it winds up springboarding off into different topics.
I seem to remember saying when we did the Monster Manual, and that was a long time ago when we first started the podcast, that there was not many podcasts or actual discussion around monsters. And I think that's why your podcast is so refreshing, that it takes monsters as a topic. And it's a constant surprise that you're able to find new ways of looking at old monsters. And so just talk us through the process of how you do that when a new topic comes up.
For the last season's been a little unusual in that we've been doing monsters from Dark Sun. And one of the things about Dark Sun is it's all new, right? There's almost no kind of classic D&D monster in Dark Sun. There's nothing that comes from folklore. There's nothing that comes from, you know, a fantasy novel. It's all from the ground up, which is both a strength and a weakness. Next up, we're doing probably Ravenloft. And of course, that's all just cribbed from like various gothic horror, you know, things. So I try to just figure out where I think the creature came from. And I'm not always successful. So I remember getting criticized when I did the Displacer Beast because I didn't realize that the physical appearance, not anything else about it, of the Displacer Beast is based on this creature from a pulp science fiction story, The Black Destroyer by, I want to say, A.E. Van Vogt. I didn't know that. And, you know, so I'm trying to get more thorough in my research, but I'm always turning up new things. But then I also sort of try to think about, what is this creature for, right? Like, what's its purpose in a game? What role does it serve? Particularly later on, you get this tendency to try to write bestiaries that are like encyclopedias of fantasy worlds, which is good in a way, but also sometimes it's not clear what the point of this thing is. Like, what does it do dramatically? You know, like, it doesn't introduce a conflict. It just sort of exists. Not that that doesn't have some kind of value, but D&D, for example, has a lot of 1HD humanoids with spears. Monsters that are, with the best will in the world, pretty much the same. I used to just think you know, they're not very good, and sort of move on from them. But lately I've been trying to do what we call a monster makeover, where if, you know, if you find one of these like little scrub humanoids, or just like, what's this? It's another thing that's basically a bear. You know, there are a lot of just like, what's this? It's a big carnivore. Well, okay. But like, a tiger exists already, right? I don't need an extra one. So we try to figure out something a little more interesting to do with them, some way to make them unique. Cause I think there are a lot of monsters that there's a place for, that there's something to do with, but sometimes they just kind of, they duplicate each other a little bit. You get that a lot in things like, so one of the books you did was Creature Catalog, and Creature Catalog is a compilation from all different scenarios. So a lot of the creatures in there just sort of, well, this was the, you know, faceless goon in this scenario, and this is the faceless goon in that scenario. You know, I enjoy the part where I'm trying to learn about where they came from and see what their origins are, think about how they might exist in a game world. But I always try to keep the idea of like playing the game uppermost in mind. And so ultimately, yeah, the goal is to think about ways that they could be used that would take advantage of what's special about them, right?
What I think is effective, James, you're quite a well-read person, if I can say that, and you use a lot of analogies with other reference points. So I think I listened to one recently where you were looking at higher level creatures and comparing them to Superman. So how can you learn from Superman and how he's used in various stories to apply to a high level monster or antagonist?
I think what everybody brings to, well, I mean, among the many things that everybody brings to a game is their own sort of, their particular set of references, their particular set of influences. You know, I have kind of a junk drawer of a mind, I guess, full of, you know, trivia and nonsense. But then also my background is in history and in archaeology and the study of like ritual in particular. Burials were my thing. And so that's kind of like the framework. That's the approach that I take, is sort of a more, you know, a more historical or literary one. Whereas I think you can look at these creatures in a more sort of like scientific or ecological kind of perspective, but that's not so much where my background comes from. It's not, but like, you can see that where there are authors who have. So if you look at the Fiend Folio, for example, and if you look at how like Ian Livingstone writes monsters, for instance, they're very often some kind of like a thing that might be on a nature show. You know what I mean? Like, there's some kind of real world animal behavior that's been kind of scaled up to monstrous size. And that's not something that I normally would think of.
I've been creating a few monsters recently for a campaign that I'm running. And that is usually my starting point, actually, the location or the environment where they've come from, and take a almost the evolutionary approach to think of how would a monster adapt to this particular ecology that they're surrounded by and the food that's available to them.
And that's very different from kind of, so I tend to start with what I want to do with it and work backward from there. I know ultimately what I want there to be. You know, my approach to things, I tend to think about them in a cultural way, I guess. Those are very different like underlying assumptions. So how does that make what they produce different? I think it's very interesting.
Let's have a look at Appendix G, and you brought something along to add to our ever expanding list. So, James, what are you bringing to Appendix G?
So when we started talking about Appendix G, I suggested talking about Doctor Who monsters, which is probably an overlarge topic. And in the end, we narrowed it down to Cybermen. And the reason that I wanted to, well, I'll talk about the reason that I chose them. So Doctor Who was kind of like, I haven't kept up with the new series as much, but for a long time, it was kind of my main, you know, Doctor Who and certain like comic books were my main like nerd things. And it originates from like when I was quite young. You know, my family moved to the US when I was, I think, 4. And I don't know why, but I was like a big, so in the US, Doctor Who was on public television. So it was on like every day, or at least in my area, because it varied from place to place. And I think my parents were happy with me and my brother watching it because they knew what it was, you know, so they wanted us not to, like, they didn't like us watching things that were too violent. They didn't like us watching things that were too like commercial, because this was something they recognized, that they knew it, and they thought, oh, okay, well, they can watch this. This is fine. at times pretty violent, but you know. But so also that meant that I got a lot of like older series, right? Because they just rerun them endlessly. So I grew up on, you know, Doctor Who stuff that was from before I was born. Like that was, you know, that was not the Doctor of my era. I think if you watch the show like that, particularly because they would play them in any order, right? They were not consistent at all about what they showed. And when you do that, I think you get a very different perspective on it, rather than like, I think most people growing up would watch that show for the years that they were in the target demographic. And then to them, it'd be like, oh, well, my doctor is Baker or whoever. And like, and that's what the show is like. And there, you know, anything that's different is just like, oh, it's got worse. Something like that, you know, that, whereas I think if you watch it from that sort of in that grab bag perspective, that becomes one of the things you like about it, is how kind of inconsistent and ramshackle it is. And that is actually kind of why the Cybermen are appealing, because the obvious, if we're going to talk about a Doctor Who, if we're going to talk about a Doctor Who monster, the obvious monster to talk about is the Daleks, right? Like, they're the iconic Doctor Who monster, they're design classic, they're the thing for a long time, they're probably the thing that most people would know about the show, right? That most people would know what a Dalek was, or at least what it looked like, more so than they might even know who was playing the Doctor at the moment. To my mind, in terms of thinking about them as an inspiration for gaming, that's actually the problem with them, which is to say that they're a little too iconic. So the Doctor Who RPG, obviously, you can make great use of them because, you know, they're the iconic bad guys, etc. There's no way to introduce a Dalek-inspired villain in another RPG without everybody immediately going, oh, a Dalek, yeah. Right? They're so recognizable. And they don't really change all that much. They're kind of just the one thing. If you watched the original Dalek story from whatever, the very beginning of 64, very end of 63, whatever it is, you would see Daleks that are pretty similar to the ones that are on the show now. That's not the case with the Cybermen. They change a lot. They're constantly changing. And that's what I think is so interesting. Not so much that they're changing, but that they're being adapted to meet the needs of particular stories all the time, right? Like, so what's their deal? Are they a metaphor for our like self-damaging relationship with technology? Are they like fake undead? That's clearly what's happening in Tomb of the Cybermen, right? It's a mummy story, and they're just standing in for like the mummy. You know, there's a bunch of hubristic archaeologists in a tomb opening it, despite the fact that like a wise man tells them not to do it. You know, that's a classic archaeological horror story. And then the rest, some of the time, they're just like standard Doctor Who space fascists. They're very adaptable. You can see where they've been influential. So if you look at like in Warhammer 40,000, the Necrons, they very clearly got a Cyberman influence to them, mm-hmm. right? They're an ancient race that they were humans and they replaced themselves with machine bits in order to overcome their own weakness. And then they're all slumbering in big tombs. And then some like irresponsible person awoke them. Like, that sounds very familiar. So, but that's not every version of the Cybermen. And I don't know. It clearly takes them a while to figure out what they want to do with them. It's a few years before they get the distinctive appearance with the kind of squarish head and the handlebars. I mean, for a while, they have those really weird high-pitched monotone voices before they get their distinctive kind of like tough guy menacing bass.
The early ones seem to have a more conical head, didn't they?
And they have like a big, and the sort of lamp on top of it is much bigger in some incarnations. Yeah, they get redesigned a lot in a way that is really interesting. And I'm like, I haven't seen too many of the new shows, but you can see that they moved away from that design for a little bit, and now they've moved back toward it with a more characteristically boxy helmet. That's roughly based on the Invasion design, and that's not until like 68. They've been in two or three stories prior to that, looking somewhat different every time.
Yeah.
And their backstory's not the same, and it's never consistent. And like, there are lots of like, I know they put out, there's novels and there's audio, you know, trying to make their backstory make sense, like trying to reconcile all the different versions of their history that were given. But I don't think that the majority of people cared about that very much.
They have some classic monster qualities as well, in that they have a certain relentlessness to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, So they have the relentless thing. They, you know, they keep coming. They can't, even if they're killed, they're sort of fearless, right? They have no emotions. So the rest of them will just come at you.
They've got the fixed expression, which is always terrifying, isn't it? That
is a
horror classic, that they just don't have no emotion.
Yeah, right. Well, they have kind of like dead-eyed. And the slightly like, especially in later designs, the sort of the hinged mouth gives them this almost kind of like doll-like or puppet-like sort of look, and a slightly slack-jawed expression. Yeah, they're, you know, to paraphrase John Travolta in Get Shorty, right? What they're thinking is, I've got you. And what they're not doing is feeling one way or the other about that fact. In fact, they act emotional all the time, right? That it's like any alien where their brief is like, oh, they don't have emotions. They totally do. For example, self-satisfied gloating is an emotional thing to do. They gloat all the time. But never mind. You know, that's not the important thing. The important thing is the affect, right? It's all about how it comes off. They also, they're ideal monsters to make miniatures of because they all look the same.
Yeah.
Do you really just need the one mold? You know, they have different paint jobs to indicate who's in charge, but that's it.
And some of the stories have developed vulnerabilities.
Yeah, right. The unique method of dispatch, right? So, they're vulnerable to gold, which is one step up from, like, being a werewolf, or, you know, vulnerable to silver. Like, this is slightly more expensive. And it's interesting, too, because it gets, like, at the beginning, when that idea is introduced, they say, like, well, gold is a very fine, like, when it's powdered, it's very fine. Fine powder can like get into their breathing apparatus and muck it up, and that shuts them down. But by the early 80s, or by 85, Earthshock's 85, I think, it's like across to a vampire. Like the slightest touch, you know, they get bipped with the edge of the little gold badge and down they go. So because it's good to have, and it's good as well, right? Like it's there's a Robert E. Howard short story called Pigeons from Hell, which is about hoodoo, and it's got a zombie in it, or a zvembi as it's called in the story, and it says they're vulnerable, you know, they can't be killed except by lead or steel. And you're just like, well, that actually seems like those would be the two main ways that you would try to kill somebody. Do you know what I mean? Like okay, they can't be killed except by guns or knives. That's not that big of a weak of a superpower, you know. So but by contrast, having it be like gold, like, okay, I guess like married people can punch them, but it's not, by contrast, like no one's ever really been able to figure out giving the Daleks a weakness because they have so many obvious weaknesses, stairs, eye stalk, blah, blah. But it's never been narratively important, right? They're kind of situationally tough, but giving them a gimmick where it's like, yes, this one thing that actually is kind of rare, you know, most people don't carry like a big bag of gold dust around with them so that they can, you know, throw it in the face of whoever. Yeah, as long as they don't try to take over, like, you know, a California mining town in the 19th century, they'll probably be all right.
I think because they've appeared in so many stories as well, they've got a number of enhancements that they can bring to a story as well. So things like cybermites appear, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so the cybermites undergo this redesign that is more emblematic of like the way that they try to update them than anything else. Because when they first appear, they look really strange, right? They look like a metal attempt to make an animal. Like they've got little antennas and they've got the kind of like fringe thing around the mouth. And then when they reappear in the late 70s, is it in Revenge maybe? Or Attack? Whichever one's the Tom Baker one from the late 70s. They turn up again, and there they kind of look like dustbusters, but like chrome. You know, they have very technological looking heads. And so you can see that someone goes, well, we like this idea that they have these weird little creatures, but not sure about the previous design in our sleek modern era. You know, the notion that they have this kind of artificial ecosystem, you know, where like there have other animals, you know, these sort of synthetic life forms, it makes a lot of sense. Like they might have a use for, you know, they might have a use for these creatures, right? Like we have animals that we keep around, not just as pets, but for other important functions, but also their whole deal is that they live in environments that are inimical to life. So presumably those would be mechanical as well. But the other thing they have about them that's horrible is the idea that they intentionally did this to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Which gets played down in the modern series in a way that I think is actually, you know, a bit of a shame. Because the notion that, like, we're better now, you know, we completely eliminated our humanity, but we are very big and strong. And if you think about it, isn't that what's really important? And is it just supposed to make you think, like, well, what kind of psychopath would do that? Like, what kind of society would think, well, you know, I can give up all of this if it means I survive? And then once you've given it up, you're like, well, now that I've survived, obviously the natural thing for me to do is just kind of dominate and destroy all the things around me. And yet a lot of the time when you meet them, they're kind of on the run or they're on the losing side of an encounter. They're sort of hard luck cases, right? Mm-hmm. Their whole thing is just they survive no matter the cost. There's such an interesting contrast as well of like the image of being like technologically sophisticated, but then contrasted with this kind of visceral brutality. I forget which story it's in. Maybe I can never remember which one's Revenge and which one's Attack. But anyway, the later of the two, at one point, I think Cyber Leader, the David Banks character, grabs someone's hand and just crushes it. And you can sort of like, that's a very relatable sort of thing. Like, they used to be very concerned about imitatable violence on television, right? It's like you can never show someone stabbing somebody else with a pencil because like kids might do that in school. Mm-hmm. And I get that, you know, but at the same time, I don't have the same horrified reaction to being like no one thinks about imitatable being hurt. So like, you know, when a Dalek shoots you, your colors invert and then you fall down dead, right? Like you just go into a negative for a moment and now you're gone. Whereas getting your hand smushed is something you can really imagine happening to you. Even if you like fell down playing in the schoolyard, you always tuck your hands in real fast because you're worried that someone's going to step on your fingers. It's really a grim, like frightening image. And it's something that you can really understand. Like, oh, if that happened to me, that would be incredibly painful. As opposed to, you know, getting zapped with a ray gun where you relate it to another playground experience, which is like, oh, bang, bang, and you fall down. You're just like, oh, those people are pretending. They're not hurt. But when the guy gets his hand smushed, I believe he comes back with a robot hand later on. I'm not sure about that part. There's occasional elements of the brutality of industrialization. You know what I mean? Like the idea like, oh, well, what if you turn somebody into a machine? Well, machines are dangerous and strong. And the things that they do to flesh are actually pretty unpleasant and you don't want to think about it.
Maybe the earlier ones aren't that scary when you see a full-length one and they're wearing some brogues painted silver with a pickleball on top of it.
Yeah, the ball thing is a bit, and the kind of like bandages around the face. It is definitely one of those things where I think it almost suffers from fan culture, right? Because these are not things that are meant to be pored over. The idea that these would be watched even twice as opposed to hundreds of times, it's not what they were designed for. So a lot of the time and no one thought they were going to be broadcast in HD either, right?
Exactly.
So there's a lot of times when you're like, I can't believe that these backdrops are painted cardboard. And you're like, yeah, this was supposed to be on screen for 90 seconds once. And no one thought that generations of obsessive nerds were going to go back and, you know, carefully pore over it. You can see them like iterating until they get a Cyberman that they're happy with. The head sock and the like dumb little hat, they're not, you know, they have this, and I'll say this for a lot of early Doctor Who monsters. Early Doctor Who monsters are very often really weird looking. Like, they might not necessarily be super scary, but they're really strange. What are the Voords? Is that the guys I'm thinking of with those weird black face, like kind of the helmets? They're a real weird design. You know, sometimes they're hit and miss. Sometimes apparently those costumes were hellish to wear. You basically like a big sack full of your own sweat. The idea of like, oh, here's what a monster looks like, and it looks like a thing in every Hollywood movie, but just like not as good. that wasn't what they were doing. They were just doing weird stuff. They had a bunch of, it was the 60s, and they had a bunch of, you know, underpaid art school graduates, like with a brief to create a cool monster by next week. And under those circumstances, you get interesting things. They're not always successes.
We're still talking about them today. So they must have done something right.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's actually something that I think also relates to RPGs for me. And it relates to what I like about earlier role-playing games, or like early Warhammer, or like comic books. They're all, or B movies. They're all art forms in which there's not, like, the stakes aren't very high. It's the same enjoyment that I get out of, you know, all these classic D&D monsters being just like made out of whatever toys Gary Gygax bought to use as miniatures. It wasn't, you know, these things were not focus tested. And yet today, some of them are very, you know, are very recognizable. This is another thing that something like Doctor Who has in common with something like D&D, which is that, with RPGs in general, because RPGs, you know, one of the reasons that monsters are so important in role-playing games is that RPGs are defined by their antagonists, much more so than other narrative forms, because the game doesn't know who the protagonists are, right? The protagonists are there to be created by the players. So the only thing that the game can show you to get you excited is the bad guy. You know, there's no James Bond. There's only the Bond villains, because who the hero is up to you. So, assuming a traditional adventure story, blah, blah, blah. But Doctor Who is a little bit like that as well, right? If you think about the things that are iconic about it, because who the lead of the show is can change all the time, the enduring parts of its iconography are monsters, right? The two most consistent images of Doctor Who throughout its whole runtime are the Daleks and the TARDIS, right? The actor has changed constantly, to a point where they made it part of the show's gimmick. So that's one of the reasons that monsters are so important to it, in a way that might not be true for, like, Star Trek is the story of, like, people like Klingons and people like the Gorn or whatever, but, you know, Star Trek is about Kirk, Spock, and Bones primarily, and its big images are those characters and the Enterprise, which may be one of the reasons people struggle with, I mean, Star Trek don't really have monsters in the same way, right? Star Trek RPGs struggle with that a wee bit. But yeah, so I think it's one of the reasons I think monsters are so important to that show. And it's one of the reasons that I think monsters are so important in RPGs, because what you would normally appeal to would-be players with of a game, or would-be, you know, readers of a book or viewers of a film, would be the protagonist. And here we don't have that.
Well, thank you for adding Doctor Who and the Cybermen to Appendix G, and for all the work that you've been doing for the bad guys, the antagonists in your work. So you're trying to add up how many you've done so far. How many?
It's not easy to say, actually, because I did a bad job of numbering them when I started. You're like, well, this is episode 47, part 2. So, and I didn't give the special episodes numbers, but maybe there are some duplicates, but my phone tells me that there are 822 regular episodes. And I know there's probably about another 175 episodes of Patron Deities. Now, to reiterate, they're very short. Every episode is short. Special episodes, maybe about 20 minutes, and a regular episode's about 10 minutes. So it sounds like a lot, but actually it's a bit more manageable. Someone just said, oh, I got to go listen to the whole back catalog. And I was like, I don't recommend it. Just pick out the ones that sound interesting to you. You know, it seems like a lot of work.
Yeah. And can you give us a foreshadowing of the things to come?
Absolutely. So the next season, so the next big monster book is going to start in October, and then we're going to do the second Ed Ravenloft monster book. In the meantime, what I'm doing right now is I'm doing all patron requests, which just helps me get through my spreadsheet. And I can tell you that I've got upcoming monsters on. So as a follow-up to the one about the academic study of monsters, I've got one about monsters that study humans. I've got one on cherubim and seraphim. By the time this comes out, I should just have released one on insect spirits in Shadowrun. I got one about monsters in Shakespeare. and I got one about some classic scenarios from early issues of White Dwarf. So it's as diverse as the interests of my patrons.
Oh, wow. I'm looking forward to those. So thank you very much, James, for being on.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Starburst Memories. Welcome to the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling. I've got Blithy with me.
Hello, Dirk.
Now, Starburst Memories is the part of the podcast where we look back at films and some highlights from films and see how they can inform our games. I think that's what the segment's about, isn't it?
Rough, more or less, yes. I think that's a good summary of it, yeah.
And it comes back to my collection of Starburst magazines from the early 80s, which I've been flicking through before having this chat. And there's so many films in here that I just do not remember. I used to read this cover to cover, but I don't think I've seen half the films still.
Yeah, it's always weird when you do things like that, isn't it? Because you think to yourself, well, I must have seen something about this back in there, because there it is in black and white or colour or whatever. And yet I don't remember it at all. It's like when you watch an old Top of the Pops and a song comes on and you think, this is number 5 in the charts. I must have heard it at the time, but I cannot remember. I can't remember it at all. Yeah, similar kind of thing, isn't it?
Got this issue here. Issue 42. Lady Stay Dead. Have you heard of that one? Lady Stay Dead. Never heard of it.
Lady Stay Dead. Is that what kind of film's that? That's a horror film.
A slasher film.
That. Or maybe a ghost story, if you want. You know, it keeps coming back.
Well, the revival starts here. Just picking up on films before we get into our chat. On Discord, I've asked the classic pub question. The hypothetical question Liberation Front have got a gun to your head.
Yeah, right. As they do, yeah.
And they ask you, you can only have one of these. Which one are you having?
Mm-hmm.
Point Break,
mm-hmm.
Roadhouse, or Heat? I think Point Break is on the TV once every month, isn't it?
Point Break. I'd pick Point Break.
Would you?
Yeah, because of all three of them, I think that's the one I remember enjoying the most. Even though Heat's probably a better film. One of those, isn't it? Heat's probably the best film, I would say, of those three, objectively speaking. But I remember enjoying Point Break and feeling like I shouldn't enjoy it because it's not the kind of film I would enjoy, but I did enjoy it. So there you go. Please remove the gun from my head. Hope that's the right answer.
Is it Gary Busey's best performance? Does that help?
Yeah. He's one of those actors. He's one of those actors, though, isn't he, that you forget he's in films and then you watch a film and there he is. He appears, isn't he? One of those kind of...
You see...
Almost like... Because he died recently, didn't he?
Yeah, not too long ago.
Not too long ago. And I suppose he's one of those kind of strange actors in that he was, I suppose, a Hollywood star, I suppose. But he always felt... Maybe in Britain, he's like a jobbing actor, wasn't he? He appeared in things. And when he died, you're like, oh, him, yeah, he's in loads of things, isn't he? But, you know, obviously never quite the star of the film, was he? But
if you'd have asked me that question.
Yeah, they've got the gun to the gun's been removed from my head and is now at your head.
If you'd have asked me 6 months ago, I'd have said Roadhouse because, you know, I've got a soft spot for Roadhouse.
Yeah.
One of my favourite films of the 80s, The Roadhouse and Roadhouse. And probably my favourite performance by Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse, you know.
Yeah.
But they've done a remake of it, haven't they? And besmirched its memory, really, by doing a remake with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's not called Roadhouse, is it? It's called something
else. I think it is. I think they're just, they're giving it a, yeah. Is it a remake or is it a revamp? Anyway, I couldn't last very long.
Yeah.
But yeah, Point Break, I really, really like. I think on the BBC on rotation, they've got Kathleen Bigelow films on rotation. They have one month it's Point Break and next month it's Hurt Locker.
Yeah. It's like film 4 shows Star Trek Into Darkness endlessly, doesn't it? Star Trek Into Darkness is always, it's just always on a loop, you know, and it's quite a good film, but it's one of those because it's always on. It starts as diminishing returns, isn't it?
And the thing that surprised my family was the fact that Kathleen Bigelow was first woman director to get an Oscar. Mm. And do you know when she got it?
Relatively recently, I would say.
Yeah, 2008.
Yeah, that's the shocking.
That's thing. Incredible, isn't it? Anyway, and of those three, I agree. I think Point Break. You can, as you always say, it's one of those that you can watch from halfway through and think, right, I'm sticking with this to the
end. Yeah, exactly. If it's on, you can think, all right, I've got to watch this. Cause it washes over you.
Ignore this. It's a rug covering a hole.
We've been looking at monsters, haven't we? And bestiaries.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it'd be quite good for us to look at monsters from films and the movies and pick some of our best and think about how they might appear in games.
Yeah.
Ahead of doing this, I did a re-listen of our Monster Manual episode. Do you remember that one?
I do. Yeah, I do remember. Yeah.
Can you remember what you picked as your monsters?
No.
Favorite monsters?
I think the vampire kind of win out on that one?
Yeah, I think it did. Yeah. But we also had a discussion about kobolds. You put kobolds forward.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, the kobold. Yeah.
There's many a fighter whose career has been built upon the back of kobolds. I think he's your...
Yeah, and I think possibly said a useful monster, in as much as when you've got very low-level parties, you want a monster. The kobold's fairly weak, and so they can fight them with a relative degree of... Well, a sort of potential for success rather than throwing a hobgoblin at them, two-hit dice hobgoblins that are going to slaughter them all. So they're kind of useful, the kobold.
It's very good, that episode, actually. Surprisingly good.
There you go. Surprisingly good, yeah.
Yeah, stop listening to this rubbish. We've got gradually worse.
Listen to the old ones. It's got worse, yeah.
Before long, we start talking about monsters in films and put forward the idea that they lack a certain weight in new films when monsters appear. Because of CGI or because of the way that they're introduced to the story, they don't have the same weight as they did from monster classics.
I still think that is true because, I mean, obviously, and I'm not going to choose this as one of my favourite. It is one of my favourite movie monsters, but I'm not going to talk too much about it because I've been taught to death. But it's like Alien, isn't it? You watch the Alien film. The alien is only in it for... I bet it's in it for less than 15 minutes, isn't it? Actually seeing it, most of it is about it, the idea that it's there. Because all the special effects are good. The special effects probably couldn't maintain the idea of it being on screen for too long, running around and doing things, whereas CGI can, can't it? So, you know, a CGI alien. I think I was at the cinema. We're sounding like people are losing their mind. We can't remember films. Can't remember Gary Busey being in anything. And now I'm saying, I think I went to the cinema. I did go to the cinema. And one of the trailers at the cinema, I went watching, and this is kind of interesting, relevant, actually. I went watching A Quiet Place, Day One. Have you seen any of the Quiet Place films?
I haven't.
Have you seen any of those? I've never seen any of those.
I've not seen them.
The new one is a kind of prequel about the day one of this alien invasion. So what it is, the gist of it is the Earth's invaded by these terrible alien monsters that are blind, but they respond to sound. So in the first film, A Quiet Place, it's about a family with a deaf child, and they live in a post-apocalyptic world where they have to just be quiet all the time. You know, so there's very little dialogue in it. You know, there's some sign language in it, things like that. It was done on quite a low budget, I think. But that's kind of interesting because the monsters in that are not in it. Even though they're CGI monsters, they're not in it much, the monsters. It's still the threat of the monster that is frightening. So the idea, if they make a noise, these things are going to come for them. That's more of the threat. And I think in the first film, and I might be wrong, but I think it's relatively low budget film. So the monster's not in it for much. And it's kind of all the better for it in a way because it's all the way through it. Is the idea of the monster, because they have to be quiet. So throughout the film, they have to be quiet. So the idea of the monster is always there. But the point I was coming to was, there was a trailer for the new film, the new Alien film. Is it Romulus, the new one that they're making? And there's a little interview with the director, and I think he talked about in the film they'd gone down the road of making the monster in a traditional way. So it wasn't, they'd shied away from the CGI stuff and they'd gone more for kind of the traditional way of doing it through
physicality, like puppets and stuff.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And I thought that was interesting because I think once you do that in a film, it's a trickier proposition, isn't it? And therefore you possibly more cautious and more judicious about when, how the monster appears, because it's a more difficult proposition. Whereas CGI, because it's easier. I say it's easy. It's not, I know it's not easy because technically there's a lot of computer stuff. It's not, it sounds like, oh, it's just easy that, but it's easier to do. That's when you can get the overload, can't you? Where the monster's there all the time.
So with The Quiet Place, then you're saying that one failed stealth role and then the whole party's going to copy it.
Yes, absolutely. They go off, you know, so worth a watch. I really enjoyed them.
But the tension busting with that would be that, okay, they're not very good at stealth, so forget all the creeping around. Let's just face this thing, fight it out.
I think if you're not very good at stealth, at the point of the first film, which is a post-apocalyptic, you know, it's the invasion's happened, so possibly a long time ago. I think if you're not very good at stealth, you're dead. You're dead anyway at that point. So only the people who are good at stealth are left. Only the thieves, rogues, assassins are left. Because the aliens in it are quite, they're quite fast and fearsome, difficult to fight.
One of the things with the alien is its versatility, isn't it? Because I think it is a great monster. For gaming, it was one of those monsters that introduced the idea of a life cycle of a monster. It's got different formats, hasn't it? And it's got, in all its manifestations, it's terrifying. So as a facehugger, it's terrifying, isn't it?
Even the egg's terrifying because you know what's in the egg. The eggs look horrible, don't they? Even the eggs are horrible. It's not done anything yet, but the eggs are still horrible. True, isn't it? Yeah, every element of its life cycle is horrific, yeah.
I think we talked about this when we talked about the thing. Infection is one element, isn't it? That's very cinematic, this idea that who's infected by this and who can you trust?
And I always think when thinking about monsters from the past, when I think of TV, obviously I'm a big Doctor Who fan. So there's loads of monsters there to kind of go at, isn't there? But the monsters I remember the most are the ones that had that infectious body horror element to them. So there's the seeds of doom, seeds of death, the one where they find the, and this is a bit like Alien. They find a pod in the Arctic and it hatches and stings this fella and he turns into like a vegetable monster, turns into this horrible vegetable monster. And of course the other one's the Ark in Space, where the parasites have got into the cryogenic chambers and the guy gradually turns into an insect. Those are kind of the monsters I remember the more, apart from the Daleks, the Cybermen, the obvious one. They're the ones I remember because there's something horrific about that. Infection, transformative, body horror type stuff. There's something far worse about it, more horrific about it. So the idea that your spaceship's got a giant praying mantis on is one thing, but the idea that the captain of the ship is gradually turning into a praying mantis creature is far worse.
The other element to Alien is it's indestructible, isn't it? So it's unbeatable. It's a sense that even in Aliens, where there's introduced lots of them, not just one, that's kind of a show and tell. There's a whole army of them, and the relentlessness of them and ferociousness of them is scary in itself as well. And the fact that it drips acidic blood. I love that moment when they realise that and it could burn through the hull.
But it is. It's a great movie monster. One of the best, really, I suppose. A lot of other movie monsters that you can mention more. So you could talk about vampires as movie monsters, but they kind of exist outside of movies as well, don't they? So,
as James Holloway says in the interview, thinking about the effect first, so what is it that you want to happen
And what impact do you think that the monster is going to have on the players? And then working backwards to think, right, what do I want to get out of this encounter? And then building it that way. So
yeah,
that is a cinematic way of looking at it. And I think when we talked about the monster manual, I put forward the imp as my favourite monster. And mainly because of the effects that it had. So similar to the alien, it's got a lot of special abilities up its sleeve that can torment a party, can't it?
It's quite a dangerous monster, isn't it? But, you know, only small.
Dee-dee, Miles.
We've got to pick our favourite cinematic monster each. You go first. What's your favourite cinematic monster?
Well, it's not cinema, it's TV, but does that count?
Yeah, I'll let you have that.
Good, you know, a gun to my head.
The hypothetical Liberation Front, Liberation Front. Put the gun down.
All right, yes. TV monsters, fine. My one of my favourite TV monsters is a monster from Space 1999. Doesn't have a name, but it's in an episode called Dragon's Domain. Dragon's Domain. I think it's from the second series. And it's a really, I remember as a kid, and it ties in to some extent into what we've just been talking about, that kind of body horror stuff. As a kid, I remember this kind of monster really terrified me. And it's amazing that this kind of stuff was on TV on a Sunday afternoon, right? Sunday afternoon, about 1 o'clock or something like that. Space 1999 was on. And I was about seven or eight years old, something like that. And it's a story about a guy, someone on Moonbase Alpha, who goes a bit mad. And it has a lot of flashbacks in it to when they were on Earth, actually. And basically, his crew were wiped out when they encountered this monster. No one believes him, and he's a bit PTSD about it, all that kind of thing. But I won't go into too much detail about that. But the monster is they find this kind of abandoned spaceship, and the monster's on it. And it's a sort of big, there's a touch of Cthulhu about it. It's like a big tentacle thing, right? Big tentacle monster with a single, looks like an eye. Whether it is an eye or not, it's never explained, but it's got like a big bright light in the center of it. And if you stare at this bright light, you get hypnotized and you walk towards it. But it doesn't move, this thing. Its tentacles do. Its tentacles wiggle about. But it doesn't move because they couldn't afford for it to move. That would have been, the budget wouldn't have extended to it moving. So what it does, you stare at this light and it hypnotizes you. And once it's got you in its kind of hold, you walk towards it and it devours you. But then it spits you out as a kind of mummified corpse. These mummified corpses are spat out. And I remember as a kid, it's like horrific. Partly because these people get kind of just walked to the death. That's kind of horrific. But then it's bad enough that they're eaten, but they're kind of spat out as these desiccated mummified corpses. There's something, again, like a body horror thing about it. There's something horrible about it. I mean, it probably looks naff now. These were cheap special effects. With a concept behind it, I remember as a little kid kind of being quite terrified. And it kills Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill. He's one of the people who gets killed by it. There you go. So that adds something to it. Mr. Bronson
gets it.
He played a rather cruel teacher in Grange Hill years later, but he's one of the people, I think, who gets eaten. But I remember that as always kind of stuck with me as a great TV monster. I think partly because it was quite a shocking thing to see as a little kid, because it is quite kind of graphic, I suppose.
So if you're going to start this thing up, then what is it? What abilities does it have?
It would have a lot. It'd have a lot of hit points. Movement, it wouldn't be able to move, or if it did, it moved very, very slowly. But it would certainly have a kind of charm. It'd have a charm person or some ability to hypnotize. That would be its key thing, wouldn't it? That if you look at this bright light, you're in trouble because you're going to walk towards your own death, basically. That would be its primary thing, wouldn't it? And again, I suppose it's the kind of monster that if you used it in a game, would you would you set it up so that players knew about these powers before they encountered it? Because that would crank up a bit of tension, wouldn't it?
You'd certainly want to make sure that people were aware that he'd had this charm ability, because otherwise you'd end up taking agency off your player characters and they would be frustrated that they were unable to do anything and walking towards their own death.
Exactly, yeah, you would. I think, though, when in the TV show, when you get to the point that it starts grappling you, they seem to then come to the senses. So you possibly get some kind of role to free yourself from its tentacles when you get to the point of being devoured. So there is that. You get a final saving throw to free yourself. But you're right. With all those kind of monsters that have those kind of quite devastating special powers, it is always good to prime players first, to give them a chance and give them a way of defeating that power or getting round that power. It's like the old Medusa thing. You know, we all don't know the statues. You know, we've done that a million times.
The other element to it is, it's a truth universally acknowledged that if you have a mummy in a game, it's got to be reanimated, hasn't it? It's got to be an animated mummy. You can't just have those desiccated corpses coming out.
Yeah.
Well, they don't reanimate. Where's the fun in that?
Yeah, that's true. They missed a trick there. Maybe they should have reanimated. Yeah.
The previous adventure party had gone getting this thing of being spat out, and they confront you first and maybe give you a clue to their fate.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd find the desiccated corpse. Even if they weren't reanimated, you'd find them, wouldn't you? Stacked up somewhere. Think, oh, you know, what's this?
There's not many monsters in Space 1999. Is that the reason why it stood out, do you think?
Possibly. Yeah. I think the reason it stood out is because it is just quite, just sort of, I mean, you watch it now and the special effects are dodgy, you know, like they are in all these things. So you look at it now and think, how could that really frighten anyone? But I think as a kid, it was kind of quite a frightening monster.
The reason why I say that is because there is this tension, isn't there, when creating campaigns, whether to overpopulate it with monsters or have them as a singularity, just a one thing that is a terrible thing that is blighting a particular area. If they're very commonplace, loses some of its effect.
Well, there's some of its effect, and also what you find in games where, I suppose, well, they have a different function, though, don't they? In that sometimes in a game, so when we've played a big dungeon with loads of rooms, loads of traps, loads of monsters, the monsters become essentially just puzzles, really, to be overcome, don't they? So if you did some mega dungeon full of monsters, you could argue that there's a bit of overkill, whereas the monsters just become sort of boring because they're all over the place. There's a monster, there's a slime monster here, and there's a giant spider there, and there's some zombies over there. But I suppose in a game like that, what they become, they're more like puzzles of sorts to be overcome, haven't they? You know, they'll have special ability. They'll do, and all you've got to do is somehow defeat them. That's how those kind of games work. They're no different in a way from a trap.
You know,
in some way. The giant spider hiding in the ceiling, it's poison spider, is no different from a poisonous dart hiding in the ceiling. It's just something the adventurers have to overcome. Whereas if you have, as you say, the monster as a kind of well-crafted singular thing, it's still something the players have to overcome, but it does not in quite the same way.
It is something they overcome. It's still a puzzle in a sense.
Yeah.
But the stakes are higher, aren't they? And I think that's probably the reason why you like Vason and Call of Cthulhu, because that's how they present it, don't they? That there's one thing that's affecting a real situation that's relatable. And the stakes seem higher because they have that sense of it's a real world effect that the monster is disrupting.
Yeah, exactly. It still needs to be overcome, but it's not as throwaway as a monster in some mega dungeon that just needs to be defeated to move on to the next room. That's all it matters, you know. And I suppose as well, in those kind of situations with some dungeon, tend to be defeated in a particular way. And that's that. You can't negotiate with the slime monster. You've just got to use fire or acid to get rid of it, something like that, isn't it? And then move on to the next room and get the treasure. Whereas in Vason, like you say, or even Call of Cthulhu, there's various options in how you defeat something, what that particular monster's doing to the world around it. Whereas in a traditional dungeon with lots and lots of monsters, it's just sitting there. All it's doing is sitting there waiting for you to come so that it can present you with that puzzle. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, but they're slightly different functions, I suppose, in the game.
Yeah, and I think that's where our clues from cinema can help with those singular monsters rather than the hordes of monsters. I don't think necessarily that cinema handles well the idea of hordes of monsters. What it does better is that sense, that one that's tormenting the protagonist.
Are you sure it's my round?
What's your monster? Go on.
Yeah, my monster, I managed to stop myself being a complete knob, Blythe.
It's a change.
Yeah, you should be proud of me.
I'm always proud of you. Even when you are a complete knob, I'm still kind of proud of you.
Because I was tempted to say, well, my favourite screen monster is, of course, Tony Soprano.
Yeah, a bit of a knobbish thing to say, wouldn't it? Because really, humans are the worst monsters. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's not what we're talking about, is it?
Well, there's something about Tony Soprano that I like as a monster, because there's some charm to him, but he's terrible. A terrible person, that guardian. That's what the stories are always playing with, this idea that he's very protective of the people around him. But he's also a terrifying, violent person with no morals.
That is a good principle or a good idea for a monster in a role-playing game, isn't it? The idea that humans around this monster get some tremendous benefit from it. Because that is always one of the strange things, isn't it, about monsters? So you do get situations where humans work for a monster or are kind of in cahoots with a monster. But sometimes in role-playing games, it always seems vaguely ridiculous that why on earth are these people associating with a monster that regularly eats one of them? But you can look at something like The Sopranos or mobs, gangster stuff generally is a bit like that, isn't it? The idea that there's a monster in a community, but the monster protects that community, but is also a monster. Therefore, it's quite a dangerous thing if you cross it, but it has the power to protect the community. That's kind of quite an interesting dilemma, isn't it, for a role-playing game?
Yeah.
You know, that this monster does some, maybe it does some good, but it is still a monster. So it will still do bad things if it's upset. Or you cross it, you know, and it's still perhaps tyrannical, but it also gives people some level of protection. You know, imagine some kind of outpost somewhere that's surrounded by threats, and, you know, they make a pact with a monster that will help it, but is also still a monster. So that is quite an interesting dynamic,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, because that's why he gives the people around him, Tony Soprano, as a monster, he gives them wealth as well as protection. So Carmela, his wife, is always trying to deal with her guilt around knowing what he's capable of, and the fact that his loyalty to her is compromised by his association with crime and everything else that he does in his morality. But she quite likes the treasures of it. So when the NPCs who are feeding this monster and cooperating with it probably have that conflict as well.
And it reminds me a bit of, like, we played a Vason, or I ran a Vason game, didn't I, where there was a community of trolls, and the trolls in Vason look human. They look quite human. So they're not obviously monsters. and they got on with, there was a local community that they got on with quite peaceably until somebody crossed the trolls and upset them. They kind of snatched a child, didn't they, and replaced it with one of the troll children, that kind of thing. The idea that these are monsters with supernatural powers, but you can get on with them quite well. But as soon as some idiot crosses them, then you're in trouble. And again, that's very much like gangster stuff, isn't it? Because, you know, there's always the thing in gangster movies, and it happens in The Sopranos, where some idiot doesn't quite realize what they're dealing with and does something stupid, and all hell breaks loose then. That's when you see Tony Soprano's monstrous side, because some idiot has crossed him and possibly didn't even realize they were crossing him when they did. But once you cross him, you're in trouble. That's when you know, and that Vason game was like that. The idea this community lived peaceably with the trolls for a long time, but then somebody has upset them. And once you do that, then you're in trouble. That is quite an interesting monster kind of relationship thing, isn't it? The monster's not just sitting in a cave being monstrous. It's part of the world, and people get on with it to a point and utilize its powers. But woe betide you if you cross it. That is kind of interesting.
Yeah. The other thing, I mean, I think it's actually referred to in one of the stories. I'm rewatching it again at the moment. Season one, where the golem, the myth of the golem, the Jewish myth, where they create this animated creature to protect them. And obviously it means that they're bound to it as well. So there is that other element to it where you can have like a contractual relationship with a monster, and but there's payback. There is something that, and you see that again and again in The Sopranos, don't you, where somebody outside of the gang who has a relationship with Tony eventually gets rinsed, because that's how he operates, that's how he works. So if you make a deal with the devil, you're going to
eventually the devil's going to want your soul. Eventually the devil wants your soul. That's the thing.
Well, I'm not choosing Tony Soprano.
It's going to come.
Hang on, I think.
What are you using? What's your monster? Come on.
So I'm not choosing Tony Soprano. I'm going to go for the shark in Jaws.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
When did you first see Jaws?
I can't remember. I don't think I saw it at the cinema. I think I saw it on the TV. Probably saw it when it was first broadcast on the TV. I don't know when. Even it was like a Christmas. You know, they used to do the old Christmas blockbuster, didn't they?
Yeah. I was.
I probably saw it then.
I was 7 or 8 and saw it at the cinema. I don't know what my parents were thinking. I was terrified of swimming in Lake Windermere at the time.
Hey, did you get in?
Well, I think it was an 8. I think you could go as long as your parents were with you. And I admire them to go and see it. And it is one of my early memories. I can see, if I pause for a moment, I can see myself there right now. Because I think it was the first time. This is a bit of parochial detail. I think it's the first time and only time that I went in the ABC cinema that was on Churchgate. So, and there was an actual queue to get in, because there's all this talk about this film. Yeah. And the reason why I remember it is because it's one of those things that have gone into family folklore that's talked about. Because my dad was sat next to a youngish girl, youngish woman. And when the head drops into the boat, she leapt up into the air and landed on my dad's knee.
Yeah. That still gets. I watched Jaws recently with my daughter. She'd never seen it. She's 24. She'd never seen Jaws. I said, "We've seen Jaws. Come, we've got to watch Jaws." And the head in the boat is exactly the same. She said, "Let's have a seat."
Great jump scare. Retrospectively filmed in Spielberg's swimming pool, famously, because he didn't like the original version, so he did it post production. There. Yeah. Let's not get into nerdy things about Jaws. The thing is that if you had Shark in the Monster Manual, you'd probably go past it, wouldn't you?
I think Shark is in the Monster Manual, and I have gone past it. So, yes. It's kind of hard to put. It's, you have to think a little bit about how you may put those monsters into a game, don't you? Because it's an aquatic monster, isn't it? I mean, this I would stay out of the water. So you've got to make going into the water it kind of important, which of course is what Jaws does, isn't it? So Brody, the policeman, doesn't like the water. It's always kind of funny, isn't it? Lives on an island, doesn't like the water. But of course the film puts him in a position where ultimately he has to get in that boat and go out there and deal with it. And I suppose that kind of echoes players, isn't it? Over there, there's a giant killer shark in that lake. Oh, we just won't go in the lake then.
Yeah.
Go in the lake. You've got to make them go in the lake, haven't you? Which happened in a recent game of ours, didn't it? When we were playing Chris Sharp's, again, things I can't pronounce, Helvetia, game set in fantasy Switzerland, isn't it? Kind of 17th century fantasy Switzerland. It's like a picaresque version, a bit like Warhammer, but more picaresque. And that was like that, wasn't there? Was it a giant catfish in the lake?
Yes.
And we had to go, but we were put into a position where we had to cross the lake. There was no, we had to. That's the thing, isn't it? With aquatic monsters, you've got to put players in a position where they have to cross the water. Yeah. Otherwise, it's pointless because you just don't go near the water.
We were quite, it's important in that game as well that we're quite vulnerable as well. We're not great warriors, are we? We were reluctant to get into that boat in the same way that Rhodey was because we could have been eaten by the thing.
Yeah, because we know what's there, but you've got, I suppose, with most kind of, with any monster that lives in a particular environment, not just water, I suppose, but other environment, you've got to put players in a position where they have to deal with that environment.
Well, I think it's academic whether it's a shark or whatever. I think I mentioned this. The reason why I went back, because I can't remember whether we talked about this in the Monster Manual episode. I think we mentioned it, this idea of treating monsters the Spielberg way rather than the Peter Jackson way. And I think it's not necessarily the fact that it's a shark. It could have been a Tyrannosaurus Rex. It could have been anything. It's just the way that Spielberg presents monsters. He's just very good at directing monsters. And I think we can learn from it. One of the things that he does, a bit like you mentioned earlier, he definitely foreshadows monsters.
Yeah. That's definitely a thing in Spielberg. I mean, there's always a monster in. The monster, might, you say, might not be a monster. It might be the big truck in Duel or the tiger tank in Saving Private Ryan. But they're definitely foreshadowed, you know, that, yeah, these things are talked about, you know. And
The size of it, you know, from the dorsal to the fin, that kind of.
Yeah.
And it's that moment when Sam Neill has got the Velociraptor claw and explaining to that annoying kid how it'd rip him apart.
Yeah. And you then Laura think, Dirty, oh, they're going to meet Velociraptor. Yeah.
Laura Dern sees this as a sensitive moment where he's engaging with his child, explaining how he's going to tear him apart with his claw. But you get that sense of how fearsome the Velociraptor is, because we didn't know what a Velociraptor was before Jurassic Park, did we? But, you know, suddenly this claw becomes very important because it's been foreshadowed.
Yeah, you're not immediately presented with the monster. The monster doesn't just wander out of the woods and go, oh, that we didn't expect that. Look at this monster. Yeah. It's built up, isn't it? The whole thing is kind of built up in Spielberg films.
The other thing that he does is he gives it a physical presence. So whether it's a noise or moving through the grass, or its fin, you get a sense of this is, it takes up a physical space, and when it appears, it's fearsome because it has a smell, it has a noise, it has an appearance that's horrific.
And like I say, you see that in films that even don't have your Spielberg films that don't have conventional monsters in, like Ray Fiennes in Schindler's List is clearly a monster, isn't he?
Yeah.
But he's got something about the way he's presented. There's a physical kind of presence to him in that film that, yeah, you can't ignore.
The other thing that Spielberg does, and this is repeated in a lot of his films, is that he has a decoy. So this sense that, okay, you think you've defeated the threat of this monster. It's either that there's something more terrifying than that that's going to follow it, or you've got the wrong thing.
Yeah, in Jaws, that is the classic thing in Jaws, isn't it, where they catch the shark. And, of course, it's the wrong shark. It's a different shark. And Richard Dreyfuss points that out to them. You know, they think they've got it, and you think, oh, no, you've not. You've not.
You know, the classic way where this can manifest is that there's always something bigger comes along. So at the end of Jurassic Park, the Velociraptors are causing all the trouble, but it's the Tyrannosaurus Rex that saves them almost at the end, doesn't it? The other thing that monsters have in Spielberg that I think is an essential quality of all good monsters, and that is a relentlessness that it's going to keep coming at you. No matter what.
Yeah, unstoppable. And in Jaws, that happens, doesn't it, with the when they fire the barrels into it and it keeps going down. You know, the idea that it's strong and bigger and, you know, more frightening, you know, that's part of that whole thing on the boat, isn't it? You'll need a bigger boat, et cetera, et cetera. The idea that when they're on the boat, the early stages of that bit, they are discovering what they're really dealing with. The scenes where they're discovering how big and ferocious this thing really is. So even though they go out there thinking it's a big shark, not quite as big as this. They don't quite expect this. And it spends like about 20 minutes, half an hour setting that up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The idea that, they're kind of realizing, Robert Shaw's realizing, they're all realizing how big this thing is. And it does have that relentless quality to it.
Yeah. And if you try and hide and go away, it's going to keep coming at you.
And like I said, one of my favourite monsters, and he's not a monster, is the Tiger Tank in Saving Private Ryan, at the end, the final scene, because that's like that, where it comes to that where they're hiding, that kind of ruined town where they've set up a base. And that has that quality to it. It says relentless, isn't it? They're trying to, these things, they're like inhuman, you know, you can't see who's driving them, but they just come piling through, crushing people, crushing buildings. There's nothing you can do to stop them, you know, the relentlessness. And that final scene where he's got the automatic pistol, he's just shooting at the tank with a pistol, and you think, and then of course it blows up, a bit like the T-Rex, I suppose. It blows up when one of the planes hits it. But yeah, it just keeps coming at him, and he's firing a gun, and it's pointless, but it just keeps coming. There's nothing you can do to stop it.
The last
similar kind of thing.
Yeah, the last element, I think, of a good Spielberg monster is to defeat the monster, you have to become the monster. So you get Quint, of course, in Jaws.
Yeah.
His face, you know, from Robert Shaw, you know, one of our good old Bolton.
Yeah,
Robert Shaw.
West Orton.
His face goes to a grin, and he resembles the shark, doesn't he? And Bob Peck in Jurassic Park.
Yeah. He has like that profile of him, the clever girl in profile.
Yeah, there she is, clever girl.
He has a lizard-like look, doesn't he?
Yeah. And you mentioned Schindler's List. You know, there is that idea that actually, you know, Ray finds a monster, but there's a bit of Schindler that is also has to match him, hasn't it? So
yeah, he has to pretend. I mean, he has to pretend that he's a Nazi, doesn't he? So the way he saves people is to really play that game of tolerating somebody like that, you know, and being sociable with them and that kind of thing, wearing his little Nazi lapel badge and all that, because that's the way he's going to save people, isn't it?
Yeah.
And again, Saving Private Ryan does a similar thing. There's a similar narrative, isn't there, with the, can't remember his name now, but the guy who's the slightly weedy one who's on the typewriter at the beginning, and they make him come along because he can speak German. And that's, there's that scene, isn't there, where the guy's fighting and he could stab the German, but he doesn't. He can't do it, you know.
Yeah.
He can't do it. But then at the end, you know, he kills people, even though he doesn't want to, because it sort of suggests the only way he can defeat this is by killing, is by becoming as bad as everybody else. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a theme.
That's a novel thing to face your plays with, isn't it? How are you going to compromise who you are, your character, to defeat this thing? Because, yeah, you have to become monstrous to defeat it.
There you go.
So, you know, direct your monsters the Spielberg way.
Oh, the Space 1999 way. With lots of rubber tubing and...
Thanks, Blythe. Now, before we go, I need to put people's minds at rest. I just looked at Wikipedia. Gary Busey is very much alive and kicking.
Is he? Why did I think he was dead?
Yeah, 80 years old. I think he's been cancelled. So maybe that's...
I see. Maybe.
You've missed him. He's been cancelled.
He's been cancelled, and I've assumed that's... I assume that's like being dead. Maybe I've thought of... there you go.
There you go.
There you go.
Thanks, Blythe.
All right, see ya.
There isn't another bit.
Thanks to James for his contribution to Appendix G. Monster Man podcast has been heartily endorsed on here before, and I'm going to do it again. It's a valuable resource, and as he says, it's possible to dip in and discover how he treats the monsters that you're interested in, and I assure you, you'll be back for more. A reminder that if you're listening to this as it's released, Grogmeat Face to Face is moving to January from November. Instead of the Face to Face event in November, we're going to go online for Grogmeat-ish. Head over to thegrognardfiles.com for more details. It should be noted too that both Blythe and I are no longer on formerly known as Twitter. Such a shame, as that's where all this bobbing started. But all good things and all that. And formerly known as Twitter was formerly okay, and it isn't now. We're over on Blue Sky as an alternative. And it was really uplifting to see a post on Blue Sky on our 9th anniversary getting an outpouring of love. Thanks. It's really appreciated getting feedback from people who listen. Thanks to patrons, because without them, none of this would be possible. A tip in the monthly tip jar over at patreon.com/thegrognardfiles pays the bills, invests in future content, and encourages us. If you are a patron, please check to see that your RSS audio feed is connected to your podcatcher of choice. I'll leave it there. I did promise to give some virtual monsters to new patrons, which I'll do next time, as I don't think we've quite got them out of our system yet. There's one more round of monster fun to come. Until then, adios, amigos.